This talk was given by Jeffrey Shugan Arnold Roshi at the Zen Center of New York City. Shugan Roshi is the abbot of Zen Mountain Monastery and ZCNYC. This talk, like all of our talks, is offered free of charge. If you would like to make a donation or find out more about the temple's retreats and residency programs, visit our website at zmm.org/ZCNYC. Thanks for listening.
Good morning, everybody. This morning I wanted to talk about trust. And as many of you know, last weekend we had the forum for the Beyond Fear of Differences here. The week before that we were up at the monastery. And so out of that work that has been going on for quite a number of years and more intensely over the last few years, the planning group brought forth 10 values, which those of you who listened to or came to the forum were introduced to. And I want to, over the next few months, give talks on each of those values and relate each of them to the precepts as a way of one of the questions that has come up or comes up is, how is this work Dharma practice? And so I want to speak to that. Through those values and their relationship with the precepts, which I'm, you know, just sort of using as a tool to speak about that alignment, that integration. And so in the early years, when we were first beginning the Beyond Fear of Differences work here in the city, and some of you were part of that very early work, we had a mission statement that I put together that has been sort of laying there in the background. And I want to just read that because it helps to express what I want to be speaking about. It says, the Beyond Fear of Differences initiative and training arises directly from the great Bodhisattva vow to alleviate the suffering of every human being, to put an end to all self-grasping desires, which leads to fear, anger, and various forms of violence towards others and ourselves, to profoundly study and realize the Dharma, and to live this real truth of this Dharma in every aspect and relationship of our lives. Guided by the direct realization that all beings are of one nature, empty and interdependent, and appear in a multitude of forms, every perception that leads to harmful, discriminating consciousness and oppression arises from false and deluded views. These are deeply conditioned by culture and society, by social and affinity groups, by family and media. As Buddhist practitioners, we should commit ourselves to being free of such illusory views and manifesting genuine compassion and loving kindness for every human being. Beyond Fear of Differences is a program of study fully integrated with Buddhist teachings and practices to help us recognize, gain insight into, and dissolve the boundaries we create within and between ourselves and others on the individual, organizational, and societal level. In short, the Beyond Fear of Differences work is dedicated to creating an enlightened society where each human being is fully and freely valued, both as an individual and as an integral value and beloved member of the world, and given every fair and just opportunity to live and realize the full potential of their natural mind. In the time of the Buddha addressed at times in his teachings, one of the prevalent forms of oppression of his time, which was the caste system. And so there are sutras where he addresses the illusory nature of defining people, of solidifying a sense of person and self and value and place and position and opportunity based on a system that is clearly designed by and for certain people and at the expense and lives of others. And so we in our time are in doing, in a sense, exactly the same as what the Buddha did in addressing the prevalent forms and systems of our time. The first of the values that the group has brought forth is sacred trust. Trust is how we framed it, and I've added sacred trust for the sake of this talk, because that's how I feel about it, and that's how I see it, is a sacred trust. Trust is bound in something that is a kind of sacred holding. And the way that's described is cultivating and earning a confidence that we are working toward our mutual well-being and liberation. And so I think both this mission statement and these values, when you look at them, really are just describing, sort of expounding upon our bodhisattva vows, on what it means to be a practitioner, on how we are practicing towards and striving to see the world in each other. The difference or the thing of it is that we are bringing that out and focusing it on not just our self liberation and sort of compassion in a broad and general sense, which has a value but it can also get lost in being general and vague, that we're focusing it into and on two of these predominant forms of and systems of view and understanding and oppression that are very much part of our time and place. So sacred trust. You know, trust is, you know, in terms of the meaning of the word, is to rely on the integrity and other virtues, other spiritual virtues, good qualities of someone or something. To trust in the integrity of that. I think of Master Dogen's teaching that each person abides in its own Dharma state, perfect and complete. Earlier roots of the word are interesting and I think helpful for us to understand a fuller sort of sense of what we're talking about and working towards. Earlier roots of the word trust include help, confidence, protection, support, to comfort, to console, to be firm and steadfast, to be reliable, to make strong and safe. And so if we think of this as a value or a practice or a virtue that we're bringing forth, and of course to bring forth into the Sangha means it has to be within ourselves, right? To bring wisdom into our relationships, into our life, means that wisdom has to be within ourselves. To bring forth compassion, it means it has to be within ourselves. You know, there's no practice of the Buddha Dharma without trust. None of us would be here without some trust. In fact, all of our lives are based on trust. You know, our basic trust that when we speak to each other, that we are speaking truthfully, that we mean what we say, and that we'll act in accord with our words, that we'll take responsibility for the consequences of our actions, that we're respectful of each other, that we recognize in each other our basic dignity and inherent worth to be, just to be. And that resides in every person, and that each person possesses their right to their own self-determination, their own agency. That we trust that just as we trust our own perceptions, even as practitioners, and we begin to question those and see that sometimes they're cloudy, those perceptions still are our experiences. And so too, then trust should include that we allow or recognize that, not allow, but recognize that in others. Their perceptions are their experience of reality. You know, if you think of taking refuge in the three treasures, this is a practice and an ongoing expression of our trust in the Buddha in the Dharma, in the Sangha. Dogen speaks of taking refuge, the character meaning of character of taking refuge to mean to unreservedly rely upon. What a profound trust that is. You know, he describes the child who leaps into the arms of their parent, knowing that they will be held, that they'll be embraced. So leaping into the Buddha treasure, into the Dharma treasure, into the Sangha treasure. And it's because of that trust that we can enter, that we can let go, that we can enter into the fundamental nature of things. It's because of that trust that we can let go of our grasping hold on knowing, on our conceptual mind, on our grasping itself, on time, on history, on consciousness. In other words, that we can trust so deeply that we can let go so completely that we realize our fundamental nature, that we experience that essence of all things that cannot be defiled, that does not betray, that is uncorruptible, because it is not a thing. And that nature can't be seen, it can't be touched, it can't be known. It's only experienced when it appears in phenomena. Emptiness is form. And so it's in that trust that we can hear a Dharma teaching. Anybody can hear the words of a teaching, but only because of trust is someone able to hear that teaching. That we can begin a meditation practice only because of trust. That we do prostrations, chant the sutra. And that doesn't mean that the trust is complete, you know, that we have absolute trust. And that's why we shouldn't strive for perfection or for have this idea of absolutes. We either are completely trusting or completely not trusting. I mean, that's fantasy thinking, right? That we live and practice on a open field that is a continuum, that is a constant opening, evolving, developing. And so when a student asks Yasutani Roshi, how much faith, how much trust do I have to practice the Dharma sincerely, 100%, 110%? Yasutani Roshi said, no, 2, 3%. In other words, you have to have enough just to enter. Just enough to enter. And that's enough for now. Right? And you go say, yeah, but that's going to, you know, hold me back. Yeah, of course it will. So it's not enough to sustain you. You know, having a cracker may be enough for now, but it's not going to carry you for the whole distance of a long trip. And so in that way, we can work with what we've got. And at the same time, be sort of practicing into those edges and realizing there's more. And so to study the self, to let go of attachments, to go beyond our conceptual mind, to forget the self, all of these arise from trust. And all are deepening our trust at the same time. That's the, you know, if you look at the Buddhist teaching on dependent origination, and it's often presented visually as a circle. It begins in ignorance, delusion, and then it basically takes you through the sort of the process of the formation of this body and mind that has senses and comes into contact with its environment, inner and outer, feels pain and pleasure, wants more of that, doesn't want any of that, there's grasping. And that out of all of that, there's a sense of someone at the middle of all of that activity. You, me. And so the self is born. And in the self being born, there's sickness, old age, and death. There's suffering. And then we're back around to delusion, and then around we go again. But when delusion is illuminated and enlightened, then that whole system is illuminated and enlightened. But in the same way, we, in a similar way, when we are practicing out of some measure of trust. That very practice is strengthening that trust, which is within us and sort of, in a sense, cycles back and reaffirms or affirms, builds our confidence, and then that trust grows stronger. So that's why it's okay to come in with 2% trust. Because if we continue to practice, that's going to change. And so all of that sort of thinking about what trust is true, and yet so much of the pain in our lives is due to our transgressions and others' transgressions against that basic sacred trust that resides between us and ourselves, between us and others, between us and everything. So when we wander away from what's true and we act out of that, or when we encounter others who have wandered away from what's true and we encounter that in them, suffering is created. Buddha nature is, in essence, the realization of the absolute nature of trust. But because that has no qualities, it only appears when we come forth into our lives in phenomena. And there, trust may be small or large. It can be honored and strengthened, or it can be betrayed. Bodhidharma said, in countless ages gone by, we've turned from the essential to the superficial and wandered through all manners of existences, often angry and committing numberless transgressions. You know, the Dharma realm, the Dharmata, is like a beautiful fabric that extends in all directions. The 10 directions, as we speak of it, which means the cardinal points, north, south, east, and west, zenith, the nadir, and then the intermediary point. So basically everything, everywhere. So this fabric is everywhere. So you can't think of it as two or three dimensional. And it's composed of an infinite number of strands filling all time and space. This is the ground of reality. This is our basic nature. When we turn against that sacred trust, it's like there's a tear in that fabric. It's like it's ripped. And although the fabric itself is unbreakable. It's unborn, it's undying, it cannot be corrupted. Our experience is as injury. Our experience is as pain. And it's not just an injury, but it's something more fundamental. Right? That's why when somebody hurts us or we hurt somebody else in a moment, and then we both move on, the moment is gone. It doesn't exist anymore, but the pain continues. Why? Why? Well, one way of looking at it is that the sense of self has been injured, which is true. A deeper way of looking at it is that something fundamental, right, has been turned against that basic nature, that, to use the metaphor, that fabric. It's like the essential nature of our unity, of our fundamental nature. And, you know, lots of traditions talk about unity, right? And it can be a kind of, we can have a kind of an emotional relationship to that. We can think of it, you know, sociologically or politically. But the Buddha realized it as reality. You know, that's why the analogy or the image of the ocean as that basic unity, that's our nature. And yet we exist in individuation as separate beings, and not just you and I, but everything. But how can that be? How can it be unified and individual at the same time? And so the analogy of the waves on the ocean. They appear, they come and go, but they're not separate. And so when we act against that sacred trust, it's like tearing what ultimately can't be torn, and yet in our being, something has been injured. And because it's an injury at a fundamental level, it goes very deep. And so when we gather together as a Sangha, we strive to create this most powerful, natural, and in a sense, simple reality, which is we gather to manifest and cultivate a living embodiment of that basic nature. So it's like we're a bunch of waves who walked in the door, right? And we forgot about the ocean, right? We may not even like the ocean. We may be confused by the ocean. Like, what are you talking about? I'm just a wave, man. This is ocean business you're talking about. I've never seen it. Right? It doesn't make sense to me. I'm just about this. It's like, okay, so bring your wave in, right, and sit it down and take a look. And so that's sort of how we begin, right? All of these separate waves coming in. And ultimately to meet the ocean. That's what a Sangha is, right? And that's why I say it's most powerful, because it completely transforms our life, changes the way we not just see in terms of imagine, but experience things. But it's also very natural, in the sense that it's uncontrived, ultimately. It takes a lot, right, to arrive at that place of no contrivance. Right? It takes so much to get to that place where we actually allow everything to just rest and return to its natural state. And so Sangha, as the virtue of harmony, is a living, dynamic, powerful, fragile, and resilient organism. That's why we have to bring it to life every day. You have to bring it to life. Bring it to life. Bring it to life. We have to practice it. And all of this is basically expressed in our intention, in our commitment to do practice, to study the teachings, to live in accord with the precepts, which is basically saying, okay, this is how the ocean works. This is how the ocean experiences itself and the waves. And so if you're going to be a wave, this is what you're going to want to do, right? Because this is your basic nature. This is your ocean nature. But we have to also do that, recognize that ocean, those waves, includes everything. All beings, all objects, all time, all space, all systems, all structures. And that within samsara, so much of that is arisen. Those waves have arisen from a ground of what we call the three poisons, greed, anger, and delusion. And that's why in the mission, it says, in short, what we're really trying to do, not a big deal, is to create an enlightened society. Not a big deal, because that's our nature. Right? A little bit of a big deal, because we have forgotten. And so how do we do that? We cultivate and earn a confidence, in part. So this is one aspect. We cultivate and earn the confidence between each other, in each other, that in this space and in our lives, we're going to manifest that sacred trust. In other words, we're going to actually have our own integrity. We're going to be beings of integrity. We're going to mean what we say. We're going to speak wakefully, right? Speech. We're going to mean what we say. We're going to try in every effort to do what we say, right? And we're going to take responsibility when that doesn't work or we're not doing that. And we're going to meet each other in that place. And we're going to do that together so that together we earn, deservedly, and build that confidence that we together are working towards a mutual well-being, a mutual liberation, because that's the only way it works. That's the deal. You can't get there on your own. No one ever has. Not because you're not good enough or strong enough. It's not about that. The wave can't move separate from the ocean. It also can't exist by itself. You never see an ocean with just one wave, right? It doesn't exist. And so Dogen said it a different way in the fascicle we're studying, transmitting and receiving the precepts, these teachings, is a mutual activity. Same thing. We practice together. We're deluded together. We let go together. We're enlightened together. And yet, we arrive in this hall, these separate waves, in this hall of awakening, as deeply conditioned beings. And that's not unique to us, right? It's always been that way. With very, very profoundly integrated karmic streams that we so underestimate. We so underestimate the power of our karmic mind, which, you know, actually may be a good thing in the beginning, because if we really understood, it'd be like, you know, why bother? You know, we come in and we think, yeah, okay, it's going to be a piece of work, but basically I got this, you know, that kind of, you know, youthful ignorance, you know, so, you know, we charge in and we think, okay, let's do this thing. And then at the point when it's too late, you realize, holy shit. But sorry, it's too late. Right? Because now you've seen too much. You've awakened a bit too much to just say, okay, you know, I'm just going to close this whole thing down and go back to business as before. Too late. And so these deeply integrated karmic patterns are of our own doing, our choices, our desires, our actions, our words. But those are completely inseparable, utterly inseparable from the world we live in, of course. And the world we live in has very powerful streams of influence, of teaching. And so the two that we're studying, I mean, what we're studying in the, you know, Bound Fear of Differences is male supremacy and white supremacy, racism, sexism. Not because by any means they're the only forms of oppression, and not to exclusively study this, but in a sense, by virtue of studying this, extend that into all forms of suffering. And focusing on these in particular because they're so thoroughly entwined, not only in our world, in our culture, in our particular national history, but also because they're so deeply personal. You know, Bell Hooks said, patriarchy is a political, social system, and I would add legal, educational, philosophical, economic, and spiritual system that insists that males, and I would add, and their thoughts and beliefs and cultures and actions, are inherently dominating, are inherently superior to everything and everyone deemed weak, especially females, and endowed with the right to dominate the weak through various forms of psychological terrorism and violence. And then we could think of white supremacy as being the same thing, a system that insists that people of white skin and their thoughts, beliefs, culture, and actions are inherently dominating, superior to everything and everyone perceived not white. And that inherent within that view, those views, and everything that flows through them is greed, anger, and delusion. Inherent within them. That's the only way they can exist. That's what they exist on. And everything that flows from those views strengthens those views. And so in that way, as Dharma practitioners, we can look at our own practice, you know, just what's going on in our own little realm. And see the exact same thing happening in a relationship, in a family, in a community, in an organization, in a business, in a government, in a country, in the world. Just playing out on larger and larger stages. And so within all of this, our challenge is to study the Dharma, the teachings of how reality works, which is our only chance of living a life that is fully in harmony with the world we live in, and then to practice and discover and strengthen that reality based in this sacred trust, to cultivate and earn a confidence that we are working together towards our mutual happiness, our mutual well-being. Bell Hooks says it in a very simple way. We cannot love what we're afraid of. Very simple. Trust is a form of love. When I trust you, right? When you trust me, that's a form of an expression of love. It's an expression of compassion. We cannot trust what we fear. That's why a sangha, a place of practice, needs to be a place in which we are challenged, right, to do this study so that we're not complacent in it, but also that we feel that trust. And that in time, even if we come in with a little bit of trust, that grows and develops. That's our aim. Because within fear, it's very difficult to settle, to turn inward, to stay settled, to let go. So how do we as practitioners within this atmosphere, this culture of domination, superior and inferior, strong and weak, controlling and controlled, those who are winning, those who are losing, those who are feel welcome and those who don't, those who feel safe and supported, and those who don't. Because we bring our world in here, in us. How do we cultivate and earn that confidence in our mutual intention to liberate? And so I think of it in terms of the great precept, to realize self and other as one. Do not elevate the self and blame others. In the Bodhidharma One Mind precept, one way we have of looking at this precept in our lineage, to even give rise to the thought that there is high and low, that because of whatever qualities or attributes I see in you or you see in me, that we impute into that a sense of inherent superiority or inferiority, worth or worthiness or worthlessness. Bodhidharma, the One Mind precept, says to even give rise to that thought violates that precept, much less acting out on it. To see all things as they are, right? So think about this in terms of practice. When things arise in your mind, an emotion, a thought, a memory, an image, we perceive it and then we have an experience of it. It's pleasurable or it's painful, or we feel indifferent. And then based on that, we might want to grab onto it and hold it, or we might want to push it away and have none of it. In other words, we support, we see this as worthy, we see this as unworthy. We identify with this or as this, and we disidentify, or we negate this. We welcome this into our circle, we push this outside of our circle. That is training. So to let go of the judging mind, to let go of the reaction, the reactivity of the mind, right? Which in the beginning is hard to do, if not impossible, because there it is. Our mind does react. And it can just seem normal or natural or inevitable or built in, but it's not. It's conditioned. And then the perception is part of our biological wiring, but what it means to us When I see something, what that means to me, that's conditioned, that's taught. And so when you're walking down the street and you see some, you just see someone coming towards you and you feel warm or settled or safe, or you see someone and you feel unsettled, or you see someone and you think, I like them, right? Or you see someone and you think, I don't like them. And of course, you may not say those words, but if we're attentive, if we're in contact, we will experience versions of that arising. So as practitioners, it's an incredible practice, particularly in this incredible city, right? To be aware as you're walking down the street and you're just experiencing, you're attentive, you're seeing different people, and you're seeing those responses that arise impulsively or reactively in your mind, right? And you realize this is not, you're not really seeing that person, you're seeing your own mind, you're seeing your own conditioning. And of course, that's the basis of prejudice, discrimination, racism, sexism, all forms of oppression. And so we can practice that. We can practice seeing that and not carrying it further, not trying to suppress it, not to be afraid of it, but to be respectful of the power of that, and to just let it calm, right? Let it drop. So that we see, but we're not imputing a sense of meaning or worthiness or unworthiness, of dominance, of high or low. And so then we can recognize, we can see someone's excellent qualities. And we're not envious. We're not jealous. Right? We're not diminished by their good qualities or their good fortune. We're gladdened. We're not sad. We don't elevate them and we don't diminish ourselves. And then when we see someone's, what we perceive as negative qualities, we can do that without feeling superior. We don't get any enjoyment out of that when we see someone else struggling or we see someone else in trouble. We may feel sad, in fact, pained by what we see. We get no enjoyment. And so this sacred trust is a practice, but it's really just reclaiming what already exists within us. And to practice in this way is how we cultivate this trust, how we earn that sense that we are mutually developing this. And that's why when, as will happen, because we're just an assembly of assorted sentient beings, right, conditioned by our culture, appearing in our particular forms, we bring it all in. And so we will at different times mingle with each other, interact with each other in ways that are not helpful, in ways that are hurtful, in ways that sometimes may be intentional, oftentimes aren't, but whether the intention is there or conscious or well-placed or not, the influence and the impact is hurtful. And so that sacred trust means that's my responsibility. And in that way, when we take responsibility, then we develop resilience and confidence in ourselves and each other in this path, as we work towards harmonizing our intentions with our actions. But we have to see what's hard to see. And delusion, by its very nature, is hard to see, right? Because it's just been integrated. It's not, we don't see ourselves as a self. We don't see ourselves as constructing mind, constructing others, right? So much of what happens in our mind, in our body, just passes by because we haven't yet developed deep awareness. As we begin to develop that, then we see more and more, which often leads us to think, oh my God, things are getting worse, you know. Where we start to realize, you know, I'm getting worse as a person, you know, We start to see, oh my, I'm seeing, like, oh my God, you know, like all of these thoughts and impulses and desires and, you know, prejudices that I have. And so it seems to get worse, but it's not. We're just seeing what's always been there. And so what needs to happen is, you know, it's sort of like to practice, we have to step into, but also beyond our own sort of protected, self-confirming, segregated world that we've created inside of ourselves, right? And we create that because it makes us feel safe, but the Buddha says actually it's dangerous because it's not based in what's really true, certainly not entirely. And that's why there's so much injury and betrayal and disappointment and dissatisfaction. And so in the same way that we have to step into the larger world that is you as your practice and me as my practice, we also have to step into the larger world outside of ourselves and realize that our experience of the world is just that. Others experience this world in different ways. And in the way that my world seems perfectly valid, your world seems perfectly valid. And there is both truth in that, and there's also limitation in that. And so to not elevate the self and blame others, to see the perfection, is manifesting that sacred trust. And so what it means is we have to both, in order to realize our Buddha nature, our enlightened nature that is present within each of us, you know, we want to just, can I just get like the express lane to that place, right? Because I'm in kind of a hurry and I'd rather just get there. And the answer is no. One, because there's no distance between here and there. Two, because in order to bring forth that already present, fully manifested, enlightened nature, we have to not deconstruct, but just cease constructing our own inner tyrant, demagogue, racist, sexist, homophobe, idealist, whatever, and all of the myriad beings that inhabit our inner world, that we are both personally and collectively responsible for. No one arrives here on their own. No one's thoughts belong entirely to oneself. We've all had a part of it, but we experience it very differently. And the purposes behind all of that is not equity. And so we have to deal with our own inner elevating the self and blaming others, inner others, outer others. And the beyond fear of differences is turning that lens inward and outward in the particular ways that exist within our time and place. So I'd like to end with a poem. When I arrive, you are already here, radiant and vast. Looking, I see my face, yet I am not you. Raising your hand, great winds are roused. Blinking your eyes, moons and stars shudder, light and dark. Already one, I never turn my back on you. Meeting face to face, you never fail to greet me. This is the way of the ancient ones who are never anywhere but here. After all of these cold winter nights, now I see it was always you that I was seeking. The Buddha realized that if we want to live an ordinary, awakened, liberated life, we have to go into the deepest part of everything. Having already arrived, it's here.
Thanks so much for listening. To find out more about the monastery's programs, weekend retreats, and residency, please visit our website at cmm.org.